as the beverage industry, I think we're in a really good place where the innovation on the beverage side itself is accelerating. We're seeing more different types of beverages coming into the market than I think we've ever really had. And I think from a consumer point of view, I think that that's really, really good. And I think that we're definitely moving in the right direction to be able to create a, you know, much more spread out market than it, which is what I think we need. I think the beverage market traditionally has been highly concentrated, and I don't think that's good for consumers, and I don't think it's very healthy for the overall industry. So I think that that's really one of the things that I think is a better opportunity, is to accelerate that and see more brands emerge meeting more consumer needs, because that's what consumers are telling everyone they want.
Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. It's a little bit overcast today here in Dallas. One of our rainier times.
British weather with me.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I thought we could get started today with, so you have a packaging company, startup you've created. Why packaging? Why get into that business? What led you there to create that company?
Yeah, well, I've spent the large part of my career working in the food and beverage industry, mostly for Tetra Pak, which is one of the biggest beverage packaging system companies in the world. And through my time there and through my industry experience that I had before then, I really felt like whilst the industry is very healthy and operational in a way that it provides for us all, there are many things that are inefficient in the market from a consumer perspective. And that there's technology that we can bring into the market in order to basically open that up and make it more democratic, more open, and more efficient for everyone. And that's really the mission behind Pasteur, is to try and democratize access to technology that can bring brands to market.
Okay. And so Tetra Pak, they're what, like an $8 billion company, huge. Are they,
what's the- I think getting close to $20 billion.
$20 billion, okay. Yeah. What's the history behind Tetra Pak? Do they own most of the market space?
Well, they own a lot of the market space in the specific niche that they operate. So they basically, the juice box was invented by Tetra Pak. So if you buy that cardboard laminate, you know, composite board box, which could have almond milk in it, milk, soup, broth, juices particularly, they invented that packaging something like 70 or so years ago, and that was invented in Sweden. And then they obviously grew very rapidly from there because it was a great way to package and distribute milk. And so you could treat the milk using UHT processes to be shelf stable, so you could store it at ambient temperatures rather than being refrigerated. And then you could send it anywhere you wanted and sell it, and it was still usable. And that was a really big innovation into the market.
That classic milk carton, like cardboard milk carton, was a Tetra Pak innovation.
Yeah. Canada, I guess Canada hasn't heard about it because they still sell milk in bags. Have you guys ever been to Canada?
Yeah, I've been to Canada, but I haven't bought milk.
It's weird. You go to a grocery store, and at least when I used to go, you'd buy the milk in a bag, like a plastic bag.
But was that refrigerated?
Yeah, it was refrigerated.
Yeah, so this is mostly shelf-stable, but also refrigerated. There's two distinct types of treatment, and this also goes back to Pasteur. The reason Pasteur is called what it is because I named it after Louis Pasteur, who invented pasteurization. So typically your fridge-stored milk is pasteurized, which is one heat temperature treatment purpose, but that gives you maybe a week or so's shelf life in refrigeration. But then you have UHT, ultra high temperature treatment, which you can basically inject steam into the milk, put it into a Tetra Pak package in an aseptic environment so no microbes can get into it, and that milk can last, you know, 2 years in that package at ambient room temperature.
Don't need a fridge.
And that's really the big part of the innovation. It means that you can take really fresh produce, process it, but it's a fairly light processing. It doesn't really affect the quality of the product in any way. And then you can have it stored for a very long time, which is very efficient when, you know, a lot of people don't live where the cows are, for example, or where the oranges are. Mm-hmm. It makes life a lot easier.
So you're at Tetra Pak, and what specifically makes you think, like, you know, I need to do like an offshoot of this to disrupt this $20 billion giant?
I think the point where I came to the idea of building Pasteur was really as we were about 1 year into the effects of the pandemic, and I'd been at home. Previously, I traveled very regularly for work because I was going out visiting customers all across the world and all across the US, working with them in the operational consultancy expert services of Tetra Pak. And I had far too much time on my hands, let's be honest, because I was at home, you know, working from home. And you know, I started mentoring for a bunch of beverage founders based out of an accelerator in New York called FoodX. That's closed down now, but it was run by the SOSV Venture Partners out of Princeton, New Jersey. And a great, great program that they had. But when I joined as a mentor, I got inundated with entrepreneurs coming to me and saying, how do I get my beverage idea into market? How do I find a co-packer? How do I find out how to get my ingredients and set up my supply chain? And from a from my corporate experience, I didn't really understand that this was a problem. I assumed that everyone knew this, obviously, because when you're a large corporate, everything just runs and it, you know, it works. And so I started helping these guys and I started realizing, wow, this is a lot harder than it needs to be. And that's when I thought, okay, I think I can do something here. And I'm really interested and motivated to do that.
That's cool. And they couldn't have used Tetra Pak's existing packages for, let's say, their new, I don't know.
You can use Tetra Pak, and but there are problems in the market. The main thing is that most of the contract manufacturers that have Tetra Pak machines and their technology are very large, and their minimum order quantities are very large. Right. So you're going to need, you know, $70,000, $100,000, $150,000 to put your first order into product. Also, those products that typically go into Tetra Pak packages, like nut milks, like milk-derived products, protein drinks, etc., usually take a much longer development life cycle as well. And because you're putting an extended shelf life on it, you also have to do shelf life studies, or you're recommended to, or the retailers won't accept your product until you've done that. The cost of that starts to put you into, you know, more than half a, you know, $500,000 before you can even get to making any revenue. So the barrier to entry was very, very high. And I didn't think that that was appropriate. And I felt that, you know, there's a way to shrink this down and a way to be able to move forward, which is much more efficient.
Yeah, that is cool. So how far into the company are you now? When did you officially kind of
I parted ways with Tetra Pak almost 2 years ago,
okay,
right now. So I think it was, I think my last day was the end of September, you know, 2021. And so I've been working full time on Pasteur since then. And, you know, we've gone through all the usual trials that a startup have been through that journey. You know, we've we got accepted into a great accelerator in Missouri. And that was, you know, really sort of the first great thing that we did. Did a great friends and family round with support from those guys and did a great pre-seed last year as well. And, you know, we've been steadily working towards getting both, you know, equipment, software and production up and running. I think, you know, if I sit here 2 years later and think back, I wish I'd chosen not all three and done, you know, focused on two or even one to start with, as I think it has diluted our efforts a bit too much in all three directions. But I think that together you need to combine all three of those in order to have the model being executed correctly and really getting in the end to the scale that we want to get to.
Yeah. So what does that system look like for that smaller user who doesn't want to pay $500,000 to get started? What smaller guy system are you guys putting in place?
Yeah, so the first focus is that we're not focusing on the protein-based beverages, the milks, the nut milks, etc., and the very long shelf lives. The reason for that is the engineering load to get there first from the very first beginning is too high. And so what we're focused on right now is effectively things like your, you know, your flavored sparkling waters, your functional sodas. We're doing a lot of work with functional soda companies and non-alcoholic spirit companies, for example, helping them with their formulations that are, you know, quite complicated. But we're doing it in a scaled-down way, which makes everything much more affordable. So I have a full-time beverage scientist on my team. He is a complete wizard in terms of working with beverages. He's built distilleries, he's worked with breweries, he's got all the qualifications from the alcohol side. He's also a botanist on the side as well.
Okay. So,
and he actually lives in Oaxaca because it has tremendous biodiversity.
Really? Okay.
He goes to the jungle, harvests his own, you know, plants and everything. He's real, just, yeah, I can't describe any more than a wizard.
I saw his picture on your website. He looks like an interesting guy.
He is an incredibly interesting guy. He was in the office yesterday and he was wearing pink ostrich cowboy boots.
Okay.
So, you know,
wow. Amazing.
He's a great guy. He's so talented, it's crazy. Nice. And the stuff he knows is just incredible. And his ability to listen to a founder's vision for what they want in their beverage and then be able to start directly translating that into, you need this ingredient, that ingredient, you need it in that quantity. You need to mix this all together. It makes the process so much more simple.
How do you find a guy like that?
So I actually found him through Josh. And it was actually part of the On Deck network. So we were in the On Deck Deep Tech first cohort that started in 2022.
Okay.
And Matt, my beverage scientist, was on ODF at one point as well. So yeah, it was through the On Deck ecosystem, basically. Yeah. But somehow Josh found him and said, I think you should talk to this guy. And hit him up on Instagram. And we spoke, got on really well, and we've been working together ever since.
That's super cool. Yeah.
That's very cool.
He's a great guy.
So as part of the process, you're not just providing the packaging, you're actually advising in terms of the mixing and that whole process.
Yeah, exactly. And what we're also doing is we're offering effectively a full operations package. Mm-hmm. So because of our experience and the fact that we've been through setting up brands, we've also been through working with, you know, the biggest beverage supply chains that exist in the world as well. Mm-hmm. We're basically working with helping the brand operators focus on their sales and marketing, and then we can take care of everything else. So even if we're not able to produce it in one of our facilities today, then we can find them where they need to go, and we can manage that relationship so they're not overspending, they're not over-indexing on things that they don't need to over-index on from an operations point of view.
Okay, so I could come to you and say, I have an idea for a bubblegum flavored sparkling water.
You're speaking my language.
It's just gonna go crazy, and we could work out the whole system to produce it, and then I could go off and market and sell it, and you guys would handle all that.
Yeah, and it's to the point where we're talking to a lot of the agencies that work with celebrities and influencers as well, because that's exactly what they need. They have all these celebrities, all these influencers that want to monetize their distribution in terms of their channel and their fame. And
yeah, you know, like the Mr. Beast types now. Yeah, who are like, I have a, you know, I'm 10 million people following me on whatever.
Yeah.
And I want to start a hamburger company, or in this case, it'd be a drinker.
Yeah, we're focused on beverages now. And I think that's plenty complex for us to take on. But yeah, that's effectively it. They can come to us, say, you know, we have an idea for a beverage. We want a beverage. We want it to be X, Y, and Z. And we can formulate it. We can sort out the ingredient supply chain. We can sort out the co-packer if we can't do it directly ourselves on our system that we're developing. And we can get them into market. And we can manage that all, particularly from a COGS point of view, because we know what the cost should be. We know what the co-packer's cost should be. We know what the logistics cost would be. We know what the right batch size is to get all of that optimized as well. So, you know, we've basically been through all that analysis to build up our own business model so we can apply it very easily to someone else's.
Yeah.
So how do you... This is a pretty niche space, it sounds like. What was your process like talking to, you know, friends and family around and then going to an accelerator? Did you find immediate reactions, or did you find like reactions were positive towards this kind of company, or were they? I feel like a lot of people don't know about the world that you're building in. So, what was that experience like?
Yeah, I think it's been a bit up and down, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, when you're building in a area where everyone has a sort of touch on and an opinion on,
sure,
but very few people know what actually really happens under the surface beyond cracking the can open and taking a sip.
This should be easy,
it,
you know?
Like, it can be kind of difficult to explain how complex and how convoluted some of these things can be.
Right.
And we've definitely had some where it's really not resonated. But we've also had many investors and friends and family, et cetera, that have really said, okay, wow, we think this is something that could be impactful and we want to be part of it. And obviously very grateful to those that have decided to do that.
Yeah. And what about, I ask kind of related to the beverage professional or expert that you found, how about the rest of the team? Like, how do you go about assembling a team in a niche space like this, especially as a startup where, again, somebody who is interested in the beverage space, let's say, they may want just a stable, I know it works, Tetra Pak job. How do you convince them to do this in a startup space?
Yeah, I think that is still not a solved question, to be honest. And, you know, we've been through some rotation in the team so far, and we're still going through that, trying to find the right people to be able to build the company in the way that I want it to. One of the things that's come from that journey and that learning is that I think that me trying to go ahead into this as a solo founder has been something that's been suboptimal. And mm-hmm. so I'm now currently focused on searching for a co-founder for the business. You know, I think location has something to do with it. But I think also you're absolutely right. A lot of the people who are in the industry today, not necessarily looking to go out into a startup, which is considered right. risky and, you know, mm-hmm. been very much up and down.
Yeah.
And so I think you need to index towards talent and individual personal leadership. And that's what we're definitely looking forward into going forward.
Is this your first company? How did you make that jump from
this is my first company.
Yeah, that's cool. So how did you make the jump from corporate?
A couple of side projects, but nothing like this.
Before. Yeah, from corporate, yeah. Like yeah, you said earlier, a big company, everything just sort of runs seamlessly.
Not necessarily. It probably seems seamless from the outside, yes, but it's not always a little bit more chaotic on the inside. So I had kind of made my mind up that I wanted to at some point start my own company more than 10 years ago.
Okay.
So I knew that was going to be the case for me. And so at the point when I decided that was going to be the case and I didn't really want to continue in the corporate world for my whole entire career, I started lining up my life to make sure that when I got to the idea that I knew was right, then I was ready to make that move.
Yeah.
And when the idea came to me, which was nearly 10 years later, 8 years later, I was ready to do that and prepared. My wife was, and we were prepared financially for that mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't know what it is in me that made me want to do that, but it just felt like, okay, this is definitely something that I can't ignore.
Yeah, that's cool.
Were you thinking while you were still working at Tetra Pak, like, all right, what niche in this space could I work into? Were you thinking through? No.
I was open to anything, and it wasn't necessarily something in the industry itself. Mm-hmm. It was much more that I wanted to make sure that idea was something that was sufficiently large that I could really sink my teeth into it, mm-hmm. and it wasn't going to be something that would be a flash in the pan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. That makes sense. So now, 2 years into the project, roughly, looking back, you touched on this a little bit, but looking back, like, any lessons that stand out or things that you would have done differently? Like, you're fresh off of that first 2 years of a startup is usually like a pretty difficult
time. At least around.
And you're still around.
I mean that in a positive sense. Yeah. Like, a lot of startups don't make that, you know, first 2 years. So
yeah.
I think the two main lessons are all around people. And I mm-hmm. think I've already alluded to both of them already, really. I think the first one is that, you know, going at it alone, particularly being a first company, it's not a good idea. It seemed like a good idea at the time. And I think if you'd have asked me even just 6 months ago, I would have still said, I think it's the right thing to do. As I sit here now, I wish I'd spent more time looking for the right co-founder before I started doing anything else. I think that would have been
interesting.
By far the best use of my time and the company's resources in the very, very early months. And I wish I'd done that for sure. And that's why I'm doing it now, because I think it's essential for the company to be able to grow in the way that it should do. And then I think the other thing is to be equally as, if not more, thoughtful about who the early hires are. You know, the old adage that everyone talks about, you know, hire slow, fire fast. Mm-hmm. I think that those first few hires are so key that having rotation on those really holds you back. And, you know, you need to be able to not get into that situation. And then you can be much more further forward than where you are.
Interesting. So you would have taken maybe more time on co-founder, but then also more time even on initial hires. Yeah.
Okay. And had obviously then two pairs of eyes really looking and evaluating everyone as well.
Exactly.
Yeah, 100%.
Interesting. Are you guys remote or all co-located?
So Matt is hybrid. So he's part-time in Mexico, part-time in the office, and that works very well for the work that he does. I'm full-time in the office, and then Michael is remote.
Okay,
yeah.
Nice. Is Matt the beverage?
Yeah,
yeah,
the beverage wizard.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Nice. So you have a Jocko...
I do.
Yeah, bracelet. So are you a Jocko fan? Do you like his pod?
I love his pod.
Yeah.
I love his writings.
Yeah.
I wish I was getting up at 4:30 every day and crushing it
the way that he picture on Instagram.
Expunges. And I have done that for periods, and it was actually great when I did it.
Nice.
Definitely need to get a bit more into doing that part of things. But I think the thing that I've learned from following Jocko and listening to his talk has been always about the extreme ownership and the point that, you know, if things aren't going right or if things need to happen in a certain way, you need to take it on yourself.
Yeah.
Whilst that may sound slightly dichotomous with the idea of having a co-founder, I don't know whether it necessarily is. And you really just need to be able to make sure that you can lead by taking responsibility and, you know, lead by making the most of what the resources you have, not making excuses based on resources you don't have.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really sort of the main learning that I've always taken.
Do you find that enjoyable in a startup versus like a corporate environment? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the amount of agency you have is just on a different level, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, in a corporate environment, you've got higher ups and they've got higher ups and they've got higher ups. And then, you know, the higher ups have shareholders.
Yes.
And in my position, I answer to my investors. Right. And there is only one person responsible in my company for everything that happens in the company. It's me. So there's no place to hide. There's no excuses to be made other than, yeah, should have done something different. And I think it's much better to be able to be open and frank about that than to just try and hide behind various other things.
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely, that's part of why I've enjoyed working here in other startups. It's the speed at which you can get stuff done, make decisions is, and even that's, you don't have to, we have friends who work at tech companies that are not enormous. They're sub 1,000 people companies,
yeah.
600 range. But even the level, like when you left and you came here,
mm-hmm.
and it was like a 600 person company where you were before, it was already that distinction between, can you just make a decision and go versus like,
mm-hmm.
you know, do you need to ask basically for lots of permission and get the buy-in and all these corporate mm-hmm. buzzwords?
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of asphyxiating.
My previous company, we got big enough to the point where we were setting up committees, and I, they're like, all right, Josh, you're going to be on the this committee or that committee. And it's like, once you get to the committees,
I'm
going to
be leaving. That's
And when you get even bigger, you know, to 20,000 plus, like Tetra Pak or where I worked before, GSK, you can be in a position quite often where you're there and your job is to create presentations to present to other people.
Correct.
So they can decide what in their presentation they're going to put in their presentation to present to someone else. And, you know, I'm not saying that none of that work is valuable, because some of it is extremely valuable, but it wasn't adding value to me in the long run. And that I didn't want to see that as the next 20, 30 years of my working life.
Yeah, what was it like working at a company like Tetra Pak that big?
Well, I mean, Tetra Pak is an amazing company to work for.
Were you in the US or in the UK?
I was in Sweden and then the US office.
Okay.
So Sweden is where the main office is.
Interesting.
And it was where Tetra Pak was born. And I was in the main campus there for the most time. And then I moved to the US in 2017 and worked out of the US office in Denton, actually, just down the road.
Oh, okay, great.
So, Yeah, and you know, Tetra Pak was a wonderful company to work for. The only comparison I had was GlaxoSmithKline, and I was in, you know, a couple of their different production sites around London, and so not too much to compare to from a large company point of view. But I can't imagine it's easy to find a better corporation to work in. Mm. You know, Sweden has an amazing balance between work and life, and it's very, very balanced, and it's very, very fair towards the employees and reasonably fair towards the employer as well. And I think that because of that culture, it's a very nurturing place to be, and it's a very hard place to leave because it's very pleasant to work there.
Mm-hmm.
I can imagine other corporations are maybe not as good, but there's no complaints about many people who work in Tetra Pak because of their fantastic work-life balance that they like to have for their employees.
And did you have a technical role there, or were you more on the business side?
So I started more in a technical role. Okay. So I have an engineering background, mechanical engineering. I started working as a mechanical engineer, designing and building capital equipment at a small consultancy company in the UK. I then moved on to being a project manager at GlaxoSmithKline, working on various different pharmaceutical production system projects. And then I moved to Tetra Pak in 2008, and I was a supply chain engineer. So that was, I would still call a technical role, and my role was to go around auditing the equipment suppliers for Tetra Pak. So Tetra Pak designs and sells a bunch of its own equipment, and I was auditing the suppliers that would make the components, the critical components, and then do the assembly and some of the final testing. And those suppliers are spread all around the world, and so we were going, auditing them, running continuous improvement projects with them.
So, but even if you're in a technical role, you are pretty aware, it seems, of the business side of things enough, obviously, to say, we can do this in a different way. There's a company opportunity here.
Yeah, and I think what informed that mostly was when I transitioned through the Lean Six Sigma team and then into the consultancy team. When I was in the consultancy team, I was then going to customers. So instead of going to suppliers or going to Tetra Pak operational units, I was going to customers' operational units. And that's what really opened my eyes as to, you know, how these factories operate, how they're scaled, how they're designed. And then once I encountered this problem on the smaller scale, I was able to see, okay, well, I can clearly see why this isn't the case. I can see the root cause of this problem. And therefore, I think that this is going to be the right solution because it addresses the root cause. Mm-hmm. But I was also in that team for, I think, about 6 years.
Okay.
And so, you know, there was a lot of factories that I went to, a lot of production places that I visited, and a lot I saw.
So you get to see like the efficiency, the inefficiency on the ground visiting these places.
Well, our job was to go in there and analyze them. Yeah. So we had an OPEX model, we had a performance model, we had a quality model, and we would apply those into the factory and basically say, okay, we can see where the Pareto distribution of losses is in any of those three areas, and we can start to do projects that will attack them either mm-hmm. through technology or just using consulting tools. And so you not only are we going in and just observing physically what goes on, but we're really crunching all the numbers behind it in a way that these facilities and these companies don't usually do. Mm. And so once you've done that across more than one facility, you start to get a level of insight that not many people have.
Sounds like Tetra Pak paid for early market research for... unknowingly.
I would say that necessarily. I think, you know, because I think one of the things that I had as an advantage was that going into these customer units, I also had the experience from when I was a supply chain engineer, mm-hmm. of course, yeah, in Tetra Pak. So kind of, from already auditing production setups. So I was auditing machine shops. I was auditing electrical harness assembly shops, electrical cabinet mm-hmm. assembly shops, different sort of single component setups. But before then, when I was working as engineer, I was putting drawings in and then I was auditing and stuff. So I think it's just been a very convenient, or maybe it was just meant to be, that, you know, the accumulation of my experience up until
added up to being I have a perfect view of the
I wouldn't say perfect,
but at least I think a complete, you know,
strong, what, yeah, what strong, I think is yeah. a strong enough view to yeah. be able to say, okay, this is time to leave corporate life and go and do this.
Right, that's mm-hmm. cool. Did you see an advantage, the fact that you were in the US, just, you know, you're in the US in 2017, is that also part of the part one, a piece of the puzzle of like, now's the time to start a company, or could you have done this, you think, in the UK? Or is the location irrelevant to the to
well,
the
I haven't lived in the UK since 2008. So,
oh, okay. you know, because you were in Switzerland first. And then
Sweden.
Sweden, and then straight to the US. Okay.
Sweden, short time in China, back to Sweden, and then US. And could you start this company in the UK? I think you can make a strong argument the UK could be the best country to start it because of the engineering base in the UK. Mm. I always say to people, I think there's a really good reason why all the Formula One teams are predominantly English engineers, mm-hmm. British engineers, I should probably say. And you know, I think that you could do it in England. I think the barrier that you have from a European perspective is that the capital market isn't as accessible as it is here in the US.
Yeah, just raising money and
I mean, it is possible. And one of our investors we have is actually a UK-based VC firm that we really like. And, you know, so I think it is possible. And obviously the cost level is also a bit lower because salaries in Europe don't tend to reach as high as they are here.
Yeah.
So I think you could do it, but I think it would definitely be a slower burn and a larger challenge.
Mm-hmm. Did you notice major differences in work culture when you switched from... You said you were in Italy for a time, in China, in Sweden, the UK before that,
yeah.
when you switched to the US?
Yeah, very, very much so. We could record a whole 4-hour podcast about my thoughts and my experiences.
Yeah.
One of the great things about working in Tetra Pak is that from a corporate perspective and most of the central operations, the operations are actually split between Sweden and Italy. So if you're working in supply chain operations like what I was at the beginning, or the consultancy services section, the teams are distributed almost equally between Sweden and Italy. And you've got Lund, Sweden, Modena, which is actually very close to where Ferrari is. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the people there, the expats, are all sort of Ferrari engineers, etc. So
cool.
I've got to meet some people from the Ferrari team, which is always awesome. So the great thing about that is that I'm not sure you can find two European nations that are more opposite in their view and their work culture than Italy and Sweden. And it's pretty dramatic. And as an English person going into that environment, you know, I came from England with 5 years work experience, moved to Sweden, there, and the Swedes, you know, they don't work the same way that the British do. And then I met the Italians and I'm like, well, they don't work the same as the English do, but they're also completely opposite to the way that these Swedes work. And that's pretty crazy. But it kind of works. You know, there's a whole sort of clash there. And then if you add in...
What are the hallmarks of the Swedish workforce versus the Italian?
Swedish workforce is very consensus built. So there is... And, you know, there is a lot of effort and a lot of time built into building consensus on decisions before then executing them. But then in my experience, once those discussions have been very thoroughly had and they've been agreed upon, execution is fairly efficient. You know, so they're very, I say steady, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but things are done fairly meticulously, very process driven and very... I would say very just to do things by the book over and over again. And it's a very appreciative way of executing from a business model point of view. But if you contrast that to the Italian style, which is, I don't want to say stereotypical what you might think the Italian style was, because I think a lot of what is amazing about Tetra Pak comes from the Italian influence in the company. Okay. I think a lot of what is amazing about it comes from the Swedish, and I think what is amazing about it is the combination of those two things. I think that's what actually makes it a really beautiful company for me. And, you know, working with the Italians is absolutely fantastic because, firstly, they're amazing people. Not to say the Swedes aren't there. They're also amazing people, but they're so charismatic. They're so, you know, extroverts, and they're so very descriptive and very, you know, hugely passionate about what it is they're doing, that it makes working with them so much more interesting than if you weren't working with them, just because of how involved they are. And you know, the fact that you can work with these guys for 12 hours in an office, and then it's like, okay, we'll go for aperitivo. So then you go and you have a glass of wine, you have some bites, and before you know it, it's 1 a.m. and you're just sitting down to eating dinner. But the whole time you're talking about work, and then once you get to the restaurant, you always end up talking about food. That's always the topic of conversation at the restaurant.
That sounds great.
It's just absolutely brilliant. You know, and the country's beautiful, the food is beautiful, and just, you know, working with them is a real pleasure.
Do you, is there like English, the standard language across the different offices, or?
Yeah, so it's standardized. You're not meant to send intercompany emails in other languages. It does happen within the offices, but the standard language is English, obviously, because, you know, it's not Italian, it's not Swedish, it's not Chinese. So most of the people who work in the high levels in Tetra Pak have to be very fluent in English.
How would you describe the American working style?
You can be as mean as you want.
Take off the gloves.
That's another thing that, you know, when I moved to the US, I moved into the Tetra Pak USA office, which is here in Denton, Texas. And that is, again, another completely different working environment. And, you know, the American work culture is very different, but also in many ways very similar to how all the other places are. I think that, you know, from a working style point of view, there is definitely a much stronger focus on performance and delivery of results rather than spending a lot of time building consensus. So you can have a more of a top-down style, which you could argue could be maybe a little bit more like the Italian style, but I think some other people would argue the other way. But I think that the main thing that I like about the US culture from a working point of view versus other cultures that I've worked in is just that direct focus onto the results. Now, sometimes that can mean that some things get left behind that shouldn't be left behind. And I think that's the advantage.
Go. Yeah.
And I think that means some things get left behind that shouldn't be. And that's not good necessarily. And that's what the advantage of the Swedish model is. But I think my conclusion from having worked in quite a few different cultures over the years is that there is no better culture. There isn't one work culture that's the best culture. I think they all work. They just work in different ways. They're all going to get to the same end point. Maybe some will take longer. Some will spend more money. Some will spend less money. Mm-hmm. Some will take some shortcuts, but spend more time on other things. But we'll all get from point A to point B, but it'll just be a different path that we'll take.
What do you think it's like to work at PastureTech? Like if, as you know, you add 5 more employees, how would you want the work culture, given that you've sampled all these other ones, to be?
I thought about this a lot when I started Pasteur, and I would say that I don't think I've really ended up on a style that I think is right.
Okay.
Yet, and we've sort of grown and contracted as a team over the time as we've had people come in and then decided that it's not a good fit and things need to move on. And I think one of the things is that here in the US, there is a more of a skew that's expected towards work versus life in the work-life balance equation. From my time in Sweden, I think that it's long-term healthier for a team to have a better balance in those things. But you obviously have to balance that with people being at work and being performative as well. And so I think that that's why I want to be able to index onto the right people and then be able to find the way to be flexible to allow those people to work into their life mm-hmm. what they need as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like even by nature, packaging or manufacturing or process-oriented industries lend themselves towards having a huge advantage from having a good work-life balance
yep.
Versus, you know, whether it's tech or other industries where you could maybe take advantage of like a fast burn, like quick iteration style to yep. get things out. You go hard, you rest, versus just having the consistency of this is a good product and process that just goes all the way through.
Yeah, and with our plan of having production facilities as well, we also need to balance it between, you know, sort of blue collar traditional and white collar roles mm-hmm. as right. well. And you can't have the same working rules for two of those. You can't have a guy that you need to be running a production line suddenly say, well, actually, I've got a doctor's appointment now. I'll see you, you know, tomorrow.
Right? Yeah.
That's not good. That's not.
That's hard that's tech. Not, it's happening right there. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. You've got to run that because you've got to produce that product for a customer yes. because they want it to be ready to ship in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you have really hard deadlines. It's not a service business in that regard when you're running manufacturing. So you also have to find a way to be able to balance those two needs as well. Because you also don't want to create a massive inequality between those two sets of your workforce either. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of things that you need to find in a way that you can challenge that and work around it. And as I said, I don't know whether I have the answer in my head right now, but definitely something I spend a lot of time thinking about.
So as far as getting you after the first 2 years, what are the kind of key goals or initiatives that you guys that you'd like to accomplish in the next two? So if we were sitting down in 2 years, what?
Yeah.
What's so, PastureTech accomplished by that?
Yeah. So in 2 years' time, we want to be with our third facility up and running.
Mm-hmm.
We want to have the second generation of our filling system up and running and our software, you know, burning through iterations. That's basically where we want to be. And we want that third facility to be really sort of trying to get those brands that have started with us early now today into a full scale up period where they're starting to become the size of Sanzo, Olipop, they're starting to think about getting into those Costco orders
mm.
and they're really starting to, you know, get into their full sprint, as it were. I think that, you know, getting the system online is important from a hardware perspective, but what's more important is to get that production footprint and that conveyor belt that helps brands actually get into market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's more scale, ability to produce faster. Yeah.
What are your thoughts? So you named the company Pasture. Yeah. What's your thoughts on pasteurization in general? Like there's debates now, like raw milk versus pasteurized.
Raw milk, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I
grew up drinking raw milk. Okay. Uh-huh. So I grew up where we drove 5 miles down the road to a small dairy and we got our jugs and mm-hmm. you know, of fresh milk that wasn't even filtered, wasn't even, you know, homogenized. Right. It was just, you know, straight from, sometimes warm. And, you know, we took it home and drank it. And it was the best milk that I've ever drank still to this day. And I think that there is a lot of value in that. I think where the conversation doesn't break down, and this is the same with most conversations I tend to find that happen online particularly, is that it's not one or the other. And it's not a black or white situation. You really cannot distribute raw milk in a way that's safe for any amount of time.
Mm.
Just very clear. You can refrigerate it, you can freeze it, but at a refrigerated rate, it's good for maybe a couple of days, 48 hours after it's exited the cow. So what are you gonna do? You're gonna produce enough just for your local market for 48 hours? Okay, you can do that, but can you scale that to a point where you can feed everyone in the world? Can you feed the whole of New York City? The number of cows that would need to be in New Jersey to do that, there wouldn't be any place for anyone else in New Jersey. And so, you know, I think we have to think about this from a practicality point of view rather than a pragmatic point of view. And also a pragmatic rather than an idealistic point of view. And, you know, the reason we need technologies like pasteurization and we need technologies like packaging is that we need to be able to distribute the food to where the people are. And they aren't where the food is produced. And that's the only way to do it. And if you want to continue feeding the population and you want the population to grow, then you need to keep coming up with more technology and better supply chains that can supply that. And I think that those supply chains should also start to focus more on making sure more of that nutritional value gets that end consumer. Mm-hmm. And innovations in packaging, innovations in processing, which pasteurization is what I would call a process, are definitely things that can help with that.
Yeah, interesting. Has the microplastics discussion come up? Does that come up in your industry in terms of, like, is it harmful to package things in plastics,
et cetera? It does. I don't know how fully solid the science is on how effective or not the sort of the endocrine disruptors and the nanoparticles are. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember back when I was working in Tetra Pak, there was a lot of talk at some time about nanoparticles, nanoplastic particles in products, and which was the best package. And the conclusion was that, you know, none of them were great. And so everyone, you know, there needed to be a solution for everything. Mm. And that's mostly because I think we've got to a point in the planet now where those nanoparticles are just omnipresent.
Right.
So it's not necessarily that they've been created by the process of the package or have come from the package. They've just come from the environment.
They're just everywhere.
They're just everywhere.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
They could have been in the cow for all we know.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And we don't also, dangerously enough, we don't know where they're accumulating in us.
Right. I saw a study that said that, I think maybe it was New York City, but just by walking around New York City, you're breathing the rubber, the burnt rubber microparticles of all the cars on the roads.
Makes
and
sense.
So you're getting microplastics just by breathing, just by existing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why when you live in the city, you're so healthy.
Yeah. That's right. I felt great coming back to Dallas.
Breathing all those goodies all the time.
But also, you know, the ink that's printed on your can is made of nanoparticles.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a lot of technology that we're pushing down. But I like to think that some of these nanoparticles could also be some of the solutions to these problems as well. So every beverage can, for example, is lined with an epoxy or a plastic in order to stop the aluminum reacting with the beverage or something in the beverage. If it was just water, it would probably be okay, but most beverages aren't just water. And so there are things that you can start to think about, how should we innovate in that area in order to try and remove that. So if, for me, it makes sense to try and look towards packaging solutions that cause the least harm and, you know, are able to transport the beverage or the product in the best way possible. And I think the answer to that is technology, not to go backwards. Mm-hmm. So I think we need more technology, not less technology. And, you know, from a food perspective, there are clearly ways that we can start to think about applying technology into food supply chains where we can also make the food exist longer without using a lot of preservatives, mm-hmm. without using a lot of artificial ingredients, and be able to have a more clean food product that we can then consume.
Yeah. For you all, as you're building, do you have a specific, are you thinking about new technological components you want to bring in, or is the primary value add saying, hey, we've identified these smaller users who need to be serviced, or are you trying to change how it's actually done?
We have a technology roadmap in Pasteur. It's not shared with hardly anyone because, you know, there's a lot of stuff in there and some of it is very, you know, I would say very pie in the sky, very, you know, DreamWorks sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But we have a very definitive sort of high level strategy that we want to follow. And then we're just taking the points as we think that they should come up along there.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. Along those lines, as we start to wrap up here, in your space, what do you see as both the big potential dangers generally, whether that's health or industry, and what are the big opportunities?
Well, I think the biggest opportunity is that I don't think that we've been in a place as a beverage market. If I just talk about the beverage industry, because that's what I know better than anything. As the beverage industry, I think we're in a really good place where the innovation on the beverage side itself is accelerating. We're seeing more different types of beverages coming into the market than I think we've ever really had. And I think from a consumer point of view, I think that that's really, really good. And I think that we're definitely moving in the right direction to be able to create a, you know, much more spread out market than it, which is what I think we need. I think the beverage market traditionally has been highly concentrated, and I don't think that's good for consumers, and I don't think it's very healthy for the overall industry. So I think that that's really one of the things that I think is a better opportunity, is to accelerate that and see more brands emerge meeting more consumer needs, because that's what consumers are telling everyone they want. Mm-hmm. But I think that that also comes with the flip side, which is I think the biggest issue, which is we can start to see a lot of more different ingredients going into beverages and a lot of more different substances going into them, where people will have a very loose understanding of the science that's behind those ingredients and the effects, and we could also create some long-term issues that we're not necessarily aware of.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I think that those two go hand in hand, but it's something to be aware of. But we are seeing, with all these new brands emerging, we're also seeing some fairly loose claims about what's in them, not claiming what is in them, and also saying what these things can do, which they shouldn't really do. Mm-hmm. And whilst I think the FDA and the authorities in the US do a fairly good job of policing that, they're not really going to take a hard look until you're getting too big. And so we do also need to be very wary of that.
Yeah.
So for people who want to find you, follow your work, follow the company, what's the best place to find you online?
I mean, I'm always on Twitter. So at Alex Bromwich on That's Twitter, at Pasta Tech is the Pasta Twitter handle, or pasta.io is the website. Best thing to go is go on Twitter and say hi.
All right.
We'll put it on the show notes.
Fantastic. Yeah. Alex, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, man. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.